Go ahead and get started. So as the name of the seminar suggests, and thank you very much for giving us a little bit of shielding from the outside noise, a presentation called The Legal Rules of Gaming. My name is Neil Wedeman. I'm an attorney. One note I do want to make is a little bit of change to the presentation from what was originally written in the event calendar. When I was originally planning on doing this, planning on doing about one-third commercial law, two-thirds intellectual property. And as I started putting the slides and presentation together, I was like, you know what, there's really a lot of meat on the IP side, and so I'm going to be focusing a bit more on that. Happy to talk commercial law if people have questions on contracts, business entities, et cetera, either in the question and answer part or afterwards privately. But I do want to let you know that the bulk of the presentation is going to be on IP. So. A little bit of my background. Before I went to law school, picked up a business degree in information systems, so a little bit of a computer nerd. Went to law school here at IU Indianapolis. I'm from here at Indianapolis. Some of my favorite games, I play a lot of D&D 4th edition, played some Shadowrun, tend to be a bit more towards the Ameritrash side on the board games as opposed to the pure Euros, but that's me. Admitted to practice law here in Indiana, as well as before the United States Patent and Trademark Office, so I'm one of the 2% of attorneys that get to call ourselves patent lawyers, and we can say, hey, federal government, give my client a 20-year monopoly on their invention. So that's me. If anyone's on Board Game Geek, my user ID is Landeris, and this is my avatar in case it looks familiar at all, so often end up talking copyrights and other stuff there. As to the purpose of this presentation, my goal is to give you a bit of a flavor of and a framework of looking at the law, especially when it comes to copyrights, patents, trademarks, etc. I'm also going to talk a bit about how to avoid problems and just hopefully kind of elevate the conversation when we talk about intellectual property. Another item, kind of before we get too far into this, that I want to talk about, this is a diagram representing Lawrence Lessig's four forces, originally appeared in a book called Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. The reason I've got it here is that I'm going to be talking a lot about the law today, but that's not the only force, that's not the only limitation on behavior. Besides the law, the market, how expensive it is to do something, limits what people do. The architecture, what type of technology is available. As computers have gotten cheaper, for example, a lot more people are programming because the architecture has made it more feasible to do nifty stuff with technology, and also the market has made it cheaper to do that. And finally, social norms are a force that affects human behavior. So even if something is legal, if that behavior is shunned or it is treated as a bad thing or the community looks down upon it, that behavior is less likely to take place. On the flip side, if something is encouraged or looked up to, that behavior is more likely to take place regardless of what the law says or the market or the architecture. So going to be talking a lot about the law, going to be talking a bit about norms. So just want to kind of keep that in mind that the law itself is not the only restraint on behavior. So I'm going to be talking about the world of IP predominantly in this presentation, and the five major areas of law that make up IP are copyrights, patents, trademarks, trade secrets, and right of publicity. I'm going to really focus on the first three, copyrights, patents, and trademarks. In fact, I have like one slide apiece on trade secret and right of publicity, but we're going to be talking about that when we talk about IP. One of the first substantive points I want to make is on copying. And the first point is, copying is not intrinsically bad. We hear that a lot. You know, back in junior high, they had this video called Don't Copy That Floppy. And so a bit of indoctrination, if you will, saying, you know, good people don't copy stuff. Well, there's a lot more nuance to that, and that's what we're going to spend the next hour or so talking about. But the first point is the default is that copying is not bad. In fact, the Supreme Court of the United States has repeatedly stated in unanimous decisions, two of them right off the top of my head, Benito Boats and Sears Roebuck Company, that copying is a good thing. If it can be seen, if it can be heard, it can be copied, and we often want that copying to take place because that is how business advances, that is how we innovate, that is how we build upon the past. Now, there are some exceptions to this default of copying. We often call that intellectual property. So if there's a copyright involved, if there's a patent involved, if there's a trademark involved, well, maybe we don't want people copying. But the default rule is that copying is allowed and copying is a good thing. So this phrase intellectual property, have a little bit of a rant that I like to go on when it comes to IP. I really don't like the phrase intellectual property. And the reason is that there's a good way to use it and there's a bad way to use it. My business card says intellectual property on it. And the reason for that is that there's not enough space to say patents, trademarks, trade secrets, copyrights, right of publicity, databases, end user license agreements, privacy, etc. And so as kind of a shorthand for an area of practice of, hey, I do all that stuff, then that's perfectly fine. It gets the gist along relatively well. The problem I have with the phrase is when people use intellectual property to refer to the legal rights themselves. Because as I mentioned earlier, we have five primary rights, and those areas of law are different. And in many circumstances, they are mutually exclusive with each other. Or the rules are completely different for one than for the other one. And so if we just talk about intellectual property and infringing on someone's intellectual property, we miss or we mush together all of these different rule sets. And so I usually avoid using that phrase if I can, except to use as a shorthand for, hey, I'm an intellectual property lawyer. The other reason that I'm not a big fan of the phrase is that the physical and real property system is set up to deal with the problem of rivalrousness, which is where in order for one person to use a physical book or to use a physical piece of land, generally you need to exclude everyone else, because if you have two people trying to use the same piece of physical property at the same time, you run into problems. So we've created this legal system in order to determine who has what rights and responsibilities when it comes to pieces of physical property or pieces of real property. That's great. When it comes to intellectual property, when it comes to copyrights, patents, trademarks, etc., we're trying to solve different problems. We're not dealing with the problem of rivalrousness. For copyrights and patents, we're dealing with the incentive problem of getting that first copy. Because once we've got a first copy, it's relatively easy and cheap to make the second copy and the third copy and the fourth copy. But we want to make certain that that first copy gets made. And so we provide some incentives to see that that first copy gets made. Well, we're not dealing with the rivalrousness problem, we're dealing with the incentive problem. With trademarks, we're dealing with avoiding a likelihood of consumer confusion. So, again, I try to avoid the word property just because it brings in all of these assumptions from a separate area of law that isn't set up to deal with the same problems that intellectual property systems are set up to deal with. So, let's go ahead and get started. Usually when I talk about IP, I start with copyrights just because that's my favorite area of the law. But when it comes to gaming, I really think patent is the area that we need to start with. Patents apply to ideas or inventions. And a lot of people think of inventions, they think of machines, they think of physical stuff you can hold in your hand, like, you know, iPhones, etc. But there's kind of four classic categories of inventions that are listed in the patent statute. And those are machine, manufacture, process, and composition of matter. We're going to be talking a lot about processes, so keep that in mind. In order to get a patent, you have to file for them. Okay? A lot of other types of intellectual property, you get instantly and automatically. You don't have to do anything, don't have a form you have to fill out, don't have a check you have to write to the U.S. government. If you do some of those things, you get some bonus rights, and we'll talk about that. But with patents, if you do nothing, you get nothing. And it's going to cost you a little over $1,000 in governmental fees, and that's assuming that your attorney or patent agent is working for free. So realistically, you're probably looking at, again, it's going to vary depending on the invention, but about $5,000 out of pocket in order to get a patent on something. The key point that I want to make on patents, and we're going to keep coming back to this point, is that if you do nothing, you lose your right to seek a patent. Okay? So if anyone here is a board game designer or a board game publisher or is working in the commercial context of gaming, you play in patents, whether you realize it or not. Okay? The key point here is that on Board Game Geek, we often use the phrase game designer to talk about somebody who puts together games. But when I was in line to get my badge on Thursday, I was talking with somebody who's been working on putting games together since before I was alive, and he described himself as a game inventor. And honestly, I think that is a more descriptive term, because many games, when you get at their core, are processes. They're systems and methods. And so even though game designer, at least in the community that I run, is the preferred term, we're really dealing with inventing games. And so that puts us into the patent land. So whether you realize it or not, patent rules are going to apply. Now, there's more to a game than merely the mechanics. Obviously, here's Lupin Louie, which is a pretty interesting little machine. And so that would be potentially patentable as a machine for how that's put together. But at the mechanical level, at how the game is actually played, we're generally dealing with processes. And kind of the shorthand I use in my mind, this is not quoting a court case, this is not quoting a statute, we'll get to that later on, but my background's in computer science, and so I kind of think, if you can describe it in procedural programming language, if, then, switches, while, subroutines, do this, then this, if this has happened, do that instead, then that's a process, that's a system, that's a method that brings you into patent land. So that's kind of my shorthand. Some of the terms that we often use is, in role-playing games, the crunch versus the fluff. The crunch are the mechanics, the numbers, how the game is actually played from a mechanical standpoint. The fluff is the theme, the story, the artwork, and that's just going to fall under copyright, which we're going to talk about after patents. On Board Game Geek, we often talk about mechanics against theme. So again, we're talking about different aspects of what we might, in shorthand, call the game, and a significant part of that is falling in the patent law. So fluff and theme are protected by copyright, but a lot of the other aspects of it are going to be protected by patent if they are protected. So the criteria for patent. So I'm going to put on a little law professor hat for a second and talk about what are the requirements in order to get a patent. There's kind of three main requirements that we often talk about. It has to be useful, it has to be novel, it has to be non-obvious to one having ordinary skill in the art. So I'll define those and talk about those just for a little bit. Useful just means that the thing has to work more or less most of the time for what it's intended to do. Oh, my bad. Well, that's a good thing to grab. So, one of the items that people often think about, well, they hear useful. Well, games aren't, you know, necessarily useful. They're fun. They are an aesthetic activity. It's a pastime. But when it comes to patents, I remember my patent law textbook back in law school. One of the patents that they talked about is a patent for a baseball cap that resembles having a large fried egg on it. And you're like, well, that's not very useful at all, but it's got a novelty value to it. People think, oh, that's kind of interesting, and a patent was issued on it. So the fact that games don't build stuff, they don't make telephone calls, they don't whatever, that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily within the patent world. The second criteria, and utility isn't too hard to show, so you're generally not going to be told, oh, you don't get your patent because this isn't useful. Utility often has teeth when it comes to how the application for the patent is drafted. You have to meet certain requirements showing the utility, but showing the utility itself generally isn't very hard. Novelty, so the second requirement, means that no one has done this exactly the same way as you have. So you can't just say, well, there's this invention that nobody ever filed a patent on, I'm going to go ahead and copy that, draft it into a patent application, be the first one to file it, and get my patent. Okay? It's not novel. Someone else has done it before. The other problem is that you're not the actual inventor. But the key is that no one else has done this exactly the same way that you have. The third key, and this is where the real battle is when it comes to, is the patent going to issue? Or if it does issue, is someone going to be able to invalidate it, is non-obviousness. And the criteria for that is what's called a fazita, person having ordinary skill in the art. So if you're dealing with, you know, cars, you look at what's the ordinarily skilled mechanical engineer, or depending on whatever car system it is. For games, the criteria would be quite literally an ordinary game designer, you know, having ordinary skill in the art, whatever the heck that means. And so what the USPTO examiner is going to do when they're trying to decide should this patent issue is, what would the ordinarily skilled inventor, not necessarily the greatest inventor, not necessarily a brand new inventor, but an ordinary one, what would they know? What skills, what education, what insights would they be able to draw? And put in front of them every last game in this context that's ever been made, every last article on gaming, every last Board Game Geek post, put that all in front of them, and them seeing that, having all of that at their disposal, would this be obvious to make these changes to the pre-existing prior art to come out with this new game? If it would be obvious, then no patent. If it wouldn't be obvious to them, then, assuming everything else is met, a patent would issue. Okay? So non-obviousness is the key. And go ahead.
What constitutes obvious? I mean, at some level, if it hasn't been invented, isn't it not obvious?
And that is one of the key battles. And this is where the lawyers really fight on what does it mean to have a person of ordinary skill in the art? How much training and education would it have? And what would be considered obvious? And so I don't have a good answer for you, because a good answer doesn't exist.
Well, I've certainly seen things where half the code, right? I looked around and said, but we all do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be to cross that obvious threshold.
Right. Well, and part of what happens is a lot of patents get issued that shouldn't be issued, and they end up getting invalidated when somebody sues over that patent, because the defendant has the right and has a heck of an incentive to say, well, Your Honor, this was obvious based on the prior art, and you know the USPTO examiner got it wrong, and I'm going to show now by clear and convincing evidence that they did get it wrong. And a lot of patents get invalidated at that point.
So, but if the patents have already been issued, the burden of proof is to show...
It's by clear and convincing. So the burden goes up a bit. And you've also got the practical problem of the judge probably doesn't have a technical background, so you got to convince the judge to second-guess the examiner. But it happens more often than you think. But the key point with obviousness, the policy goal, is that we're not wanting to give out these 20-year monopolies. We're not wanting to infringe on this default right to freely copy for every last new step in the art. If it's a real step, if it's a significant step, then we want to give that incentive. We want to give that 20-year monopoly. But if it's just the steps and innovations that we would expect normally, just because if you innovate on something, oftentimes there's going to be some commercial advantage. If that's enough of an incentive, we don't want to give the patent to it. And so we come up with a standard of non-obviousness, which is extremely loose language. And it's that's where the fight is. That's where the lawyers go to battle on, is this obvious or not? But that's the text that we're fighting over. So, the exclusive rights of patents. The five exclusive rights of a patent holder are make, use, sell, offer for sale, and export. You're welcome to write them down, but the key point I want to make on this is that use is one of the rights. When we get to copyright, use is not one of the rights. But when it comes to patents, use is one of the rights. Now, these rights are negative rights, which means that it is a right to exclude others from using. It is not the right to use the patent yourself. And so oftentimes, people will get a patent on an invention that some subset or subcomponent of the invention is actually patented by somebody else. And so you have what are called blocking patents, and the two parties have to get together and work out a licensing deal, or else, you know, you can't do business. But the key point with a patent is that it's not the right to use it, it's the right to exclude others from using it. So, patents and gaming. Patents are relatively rare in the gaming world, at least relative to copyrights and trademarks, the rights that assume automatically and more or less for free. And the reason for that is that a lot of people that work in the gaming industry, game design or game publishing isn't necessarily their day job. They have something else that they're doing, or this is something that they're trying to build up, or you know they're not making a huge amount of money on it, so dropping $5,000 more or less just isn't in the budget. So you don't see a huge amount of patents. You're starting to see some, you're starting to see more, especially as the industry is maturing and a bit more money is flowing into it. But the key is that there are a lot of new game mechanics that, in my view, are potentially patentable, but because people aren't filing for them because of the money involved, they're flowing into the public domain. Now, that's intentionally how the system is set up. It's meant to say, look, you've got 1 year in order to file for this, for your patent, or else everyone gains the right to copy it. Everyone gains the right to build upon it.
1 year from what?
I'm sorry?
1 year from what?
1 year from the date of public use, which is actually our very next slide. That's an excellent question. You've got my exact train of thought. So, 35 U.S.C. section 102B. You can look it up if you want to get the text of it afterwards. But the key point with this piece of statute is that it says you have 1 year from when the invention goes into public use or the public becomes aware of it. Okay, now there's some specific, items that are listed, such as it becomes patented in another country or it's in a printed publication or it's put in the public use. But the key point is, once you take it out of your garage, once you take it out of your, private play group that you have sworn to secrecy, once you make it available to third parties, a one-year clock starts ticking, in which case it's file for that patent application, get it on file within 1 year, or no patent.
Do I have to do that, or someone,
Well, only the actual inventor is allowed to file the application.
So someone writes something up on BoardGameGeek based on hearsay, and the fact that it's true doesn't affect my...
Well, no, that will, again, if it's in a printed publication...
Though I didn't intentionally put it out...
Right, intent is not part of it.
Okay.
That will go into some of the factual questions. If it's someone that you have a relationship with, was this a public use, did you, prevent them from publicly sharing it, et cetera. But the key point, I'll get you right, just one second, is that once the invention itself, once a game designer of ordinary skill in the art is enabled by the Board Game Geek Post, by the prototype that you're playing openly at Gen Con, by whatever it is, once the public has access to it, because we have this default rule of whatever you can see, whatever you can hear, whatever, you can copy and build upon. That's our default. Once you've made the public aware of it, even if it's just one or two people, then that one-year timer starts ticking. Your question.
What about incomplete process? For instance, you have a alpha prototype.
Mm-hmm.
You say, here's my playtest on my website.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the final process.
Mm-hmm.
But does the clock start for your final process?
Well, it's what it's going to depend on. In patents, we often say the name of the game is the claims. And the claims are where you take this game, you take this technology, you take whatever it is, and you turn it into English language sentences. You know, because again, people, you know, have these thoughts about patents that, well, it's on inventions, it's on these particular machines, it's on this. Well, no, it's actually not. It's on this long list of sentences in which you're verbally describing what the inventive concept is. And so what's going to happen is that if it's challenged or if the examiner's looking at the application, they're going to say, well, he's claiming this, 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 and this. Let's look at this prior art. Let's look at this Board Game Geek post. Let's look at his website. Let's look at whatever it is. And having this document available, would a game designer of ordinary skill in the art be enabled to come up with what it is that you are claiming? If yes, then it anticipates you or it bars you based on that one-year timer. If it doesn't enable them to come up with all of what you're claiming, then no. It might render it obvious, okay? But the key point is it's going to depend on what it is you're claiming. It's going to depend on how you describe the inventive concept for what you are seeking that patent. I know these are some crazy stuff. We're trying to put fence posts around ideas. But the key point is, how much are you disclosing? Are you disclosing what it is you're seeking the patent on? If yes, then you've got 1 year from that date. If not, then it might render it obvious, but it's not going to strictly make it not. Okay? So, the key points on 102B is that generally it's going to be public use or printed publications. And your own website, your Kickstarter page, BoardGameGeek, those are printed publications. Those can anticipate you or bar you.
Does a provisional patent extend that year, or is that just something you get during that?
What the provisional patent application does is you get 1 year from when you file the provisional patent application to file a real patent application, okay? And if all of the material that you're relying upon in your real patent application is found within the provisional, then you get the priority date, okay? So I guess, you could file the provisional 1 day before the timer runs out, and then 1 year later file the real application, because that real application will be treated as having the priority date of your provisional. So it does kind of extend your timer for one more year, just because the real application is going to be treated as having the provisional's priority date, so long as everything you rely upon in the real application is disclosed in the provisional. So, slide here with a little birthday cake is 1 year. I repeat, 1 year to get it on file. So, limitations and exceptions to patents. Limitations and exceptions are really important to copyright and trademark. We'll talk about them. There really aren't too many limitations and exceptions when it comes to patents. There's this experimental use one, but it's very, very narrow. So with patents, it's more or less all or nothing. Either it's patented and you can't make, use, sell, offer for sale, or import it, or it's not patented, which means, when it comes to machines, manufacturers, processes, compositions of matter, it's in the public domain, and anyone can use it. In copyright, we have this concept called fair use that we'll be talking about, which kind of says, well, don't take too much or don't interfere with the market for the original work, and it's considered a fair use. There's no fair use when it comes to patents. Either it's in the public domain or it's not. Either it's patented or it's not. So patents are very much all or nothing. Look like you had a question on your lips. But okay.
I'm just trying to think, okay, what have I done with the prototype of my game? Have I broken this barrier?
Right. And I'm happy to talk with you afterwards if you want to talk some of the specifics and get my thoughts on that. Okay.
Have you play tested it? You've broken the barrier.
Well, the question is, have you play tested it publicly? Okay, it's all about what is the public in possession of. So if you've made it publicly accessible via printed publication, such as a website, or you've posted on BoardGameGeek saying, here's this
I walk into a game store with the owner of the game store, and I sit down and I show them my game.
Well, that's going to be what we call a fact question. Is he a member of the public? Do you have a prior relationship with him? And, you know, it's really tough for me to say without knowing more, and it's one of those situations where lawyers can disagree on the interpretation of that, and ultimately a judge would have to make the determination. So you're kind of walking into what is inherently a gray area.
Okay.
Would a non-disclosure agreement protect you on that?
That's going to help quite a bit because you're not making it publicly available. You're telling people, you know, I need to have other people working on this in order to experiment with it, in order to build it up. And so those NDAs are going to help prevent that one-year clock from starting. So, yeah?
Closed forums online, say if I'm working with somebody who's traveling or across the country all the time, does that start the clock?
Is the public, the key question is going
to... Basically, if you've got an NDA, you choose some people to help you close playtest this. Mm-hmm. It's these people, nobody else, you saying, hey, don't talk about this to anybody. This mm-hmm. is not directly involved. You got NDA signed with them, and then you start a forum online. Posts on the forum, emails back and forth between, and that sort of thing. Does that break the public barrier if someone were to get a hold of it?
My gut feel, the more people you have involved, the more likely it is that it's going to be starting to trigger members of the public. And it also depends on, how widely spread. So I can't give you a straight answer on that one just because it's kind of a bit of a gray area, but something that you definitely need to be aware of on, ooh, this is getting to the point where perhaps this one-year timer is going to start. And I'm happy to talk with you a bit more afterwards, you know, do a little bit of research, give you some more information on that. How to avoid trouble when it comes to patents. If you want to build upon or market a product that's similar to something that's patented, you definitely want to talk with an IP lawyer because the name of the game is the claims, and those claims are going to determine exactly what the contours are of what's covered by the patent, what's in the public domain. The claims are going to determine the exact scope of the boundaries. It's not the finished product that's available for commercial sale. It's going to be the claims. It's going to be these English language definitions and descriptions of what the inventive concept is. It's also possible to infringe a patent without even knowing of its existence. So ignorance is no defense. That might limit your damages, so it wouldn't be considered willful infringement with treble damages. But the key thing is that you can violate a patent without even knowing of its existence. Patents, these are an exception to the rule that mechanics are freely reusable. If you want a patent, you got to file one within 1 year of public use. Again, coming back to that point. The other point that I want to make on this is that even if something isn't patented, even if the law says, well, from the patent perspective, this is fair game, it's in the public domain, norms may still be against that. Okay? And specifically, one of the norms that I'm seeing in the Board Game Geek community is that generally, when it comes to game mechanics, using portions of a game, building upon them, coming up with something that's a little bit different and or using it non-commercially is generally allowed and considered. That's cool. No one has a problem with that. Taking all of the mechanics and just putting a different theme on it or making your own version at home, some people say, hey, that's not cool. But that's dealing with the social norms, which are very important, especially when you've got an industry in which a lot of people know a lot of other people, relatively small. And so simply because it's legal or it's, there's no cause of action against you doesn't mean that it's not going to be frowned upon and that it perhaps, isn't something that you, quote-unquote, should be doing. These are really intense, involved debates and discussions. So just be aware of the social norms aspect of this. In my opinion, reuse of what's in the public domain is to be encouraged. It's the public's property as much as anyone else's. But other people disagree with that. And so we're dealing with some pretty involved discussions and debates, and that's okay. So, on to copyright. So,
how would we know? I mean, mm-hmm. like you said, ignorance is no excuse for right. that. But I mean, there's no requirement that patents are marked or labeled.
They do have to be marked. So once the patent is used, that, you know, in fact, if you'd like, for example, Wits and Wagers is one of the games that comes to mind that has two patents on it. And so if you get the current copy of the game, it'll say you protected by U.S. patent number, yada, 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 yada. The version of the game I have on my bookshelf says patent pending, because the patent hadn't issued yet. So, you know, again, we've got this default right to freely copy, and so we want to put the public on notice that it's patented. So, hey, don't copy this. But, yeah.
Does patent pending actually protect you from any...
No, what that's going to do is that's going to determine what the damages are if someone infringes the patent, if the patent ultimately issues, because the patent issues with priority back to the date of the application. So if somebody ends up copying it between the time you file, prior to the patent issuing, but after you file for the application, you can get an injunction against them to make them stop. But it will determine what the level of damage, the monetary damage is. So, you had a question?
Yeah. In your opinion, patenting the specific mechanics, the kernels of the game that you make up with the players is two patents. Sometimes what I see in 48D for a conversation.
Right, you get a patent on claims.
Right, so like Wizards of the Coast happened. You didn't get a patent on the game in which magic spells are represented by.
Right, you get a patent on a process of doing stuff in order to play a game as determined by the language within the claims. So. Copyright, my personal favorite area of the law. Copyright is instant and automatic in the industrialized world, which basically means. You don't need to mail yourself a copy of whatever it is that you run into copyright and keep it sealed until that moment in the courtroom where you rip the envelope open and show that you did, in fact, write this. That has some small evidentiary value, but your copyright is instant and automatic. Save yourself the postage, in my opinion. The basic set of rights with copyrights come without any need for registration, any need for this poor man's copyright of sending it to yourself through the mail. Now, if you take the half an hour to fill out a form and write a check to the U.S. government for $35, you get extra set of rights that we'll talk about. And I think that that's generally worthwhile. But you're not required to do that in order to get the basic set of rights.
The price go up?
I'm sorry?
The price go up?
Last I checked, it's $35 for electronic. I think it's 60 if you want to fill out the paper. Or maybe it's 30. It's cheap. It's a key thing. So, you might be a copyright holder if. Copyright applies to all original works of authorship fixed in a tangible medium of expression. So, what that means is that it has to be original to you. You can't just copy something and say, hey, look, I have a copyright in this. It also has to be fixed in a tangible medium of expression. So, just your thoughts that haven't been verbalized, no copyright there. An impromptu talk or conversation you have with someone, no copyright there. This talk, there's a copyright because I've tangibly fixed my slides and notes that you guys can't see, but I can see on my phone. And so, you know, kind of this would flow into the copyright from that. But the key points here is, did you come up with something expressive? Was it original to you? Is it in some tangible medium? If the answer is yes, then congratulations, you have a copyright. I'd wager that pretty much everyone in here is a copyright holder because you've sent an email or you've doodled on a piece of paper or whatever. Congratulations, you have a copyright. So, basic rights when it comes to copyrights. These are reproduction, distribution, public display, public performance, and derivative work. So it is a right to exclude others from doing those things. Note that there is no right of use. We often in our language and discussions and debates run into this, the shorthand of, well, you can't use anything that's copyrighted without permission. No, you can't reproduce it. You can't distribute it, you can't publicly display it, you can't publicly perform it, and you can't create derivative works. You can privately perform it. You can cut it up. You can set fire to it. You can do whatever you want except reproduce, distribute, publicly display, publicly perform, and create derivative works. So some common fact patterns when it comes to gaming and copyright. Anybody here ever photographed a work or make a digital copy of a work, which basically means play a game on a computer? Because all computers do is copy stuff. Well, that implicates the reproduction right. Anybody here ever sold a game or gave a game away to somebody? Well, that's a distribution. Anybody here ever set up a game in a public place, such as at Gen Con? Well, that's public display. Anybody else here applied a printed rule set in a public place, such as perhaps, you know, playing a game at a convention? That's arguably a public performance of those printed rules. Anybody here ever painted a miniature at home? Well, you're creating a derivative work of the sculpture. So, congratulations, anyone who's done that. The FBI is waiting outside. You are copyright thieves. You will be hauled off to prison because you have violated the exclusive rights of the copyright holder. Now, of course, that's absurd. But why is that absurd? Why do I mention all these common activities that everyone says, well, that's fair, that's fine, that's not a problem, that's not an intellectual property theft? Well, the reason for that is that there are numerous limitations and exceptions to copyright. And again, all of those are literally reproductions or distributions or derivative works of copyrighted works. But they're not infringements of copyright because we have these limitations and exceptions to copyright. We give all these rights instantly and automatically, and then we say, well, wait a second, maybe they're not as exclusive as we call them, and we're going to carve some stuff out. And limitations and exceptions, they are an intentional part of the system. 2003, the Supreme Court of the United States said that limitations and exceptions to copyright are how the First Amendment is able to coexist with copyright. If Congress passed a law tomorrow that said fair use no longer exists, there's a really strong argument that that would be an unconstitutional act because it would be infringing on the freedom of speech. Okay? So what are some key limitations and exceptions to copyright? Well, one of the first ones is the idea-expression dichotomy, this concept that ideas are in the public domain from the copyright perspective, but expression is covered by copyright. Now, ideas may be patented, but when it comes to copyright, they are outside of copyright. So game mechanics, they're akin to ideas, and so they are public domain from a copyright perspective. Another key limitation and exception is first sale, which says that if you lawfully possess a specific copy of a copyrighted work, you can distribute or publicly display that work without infringing on the copyright. So this is what lets you sell or trade out your game, so long as you didn't steal the game in the first place. As long as you lawfully acquired it, you can send it on down the chain. The final limitation exception I want to talk about is fair use, which is this flexible but amorphous, which is to say it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I've been studying this for 10 years, and it's really, really difficult to say with any certainty ahead of time, this is a fair use, this isn't a fair use. It's simply a matter of, it's more likely to be a fair use, or here's the stuff that suggests it's a fair use, but here's the stuff that comes against. We basically have four factors in the statute that say, look at these and try and sort it out. The key point with fair use is we're trying to provide some language that's technology neutral to allow, you know, later generations to make use of copyrighted works in a fair way, but we can't possibly write down every possible situation that might arise, and so we kind of put these standards, these signposts. Is it a transformative use? Is it a non-commercial use? Is it an educational use? Well, that's more likely to be fair. Is it a use that is interfering with the market for the original work? Is it a displacive use, if you will? I think I just made that word up. Is it displacing sales of the original work? Well, that's less likely to be a fair use. Are you using the whole darn thing? Are you using more than you need to? Well, that's less likely to be a fair use. Are you dealing with factual materials? Are you, you know, using a section of a textbook? Well, that's more likely to be a fair use. So we've got these factors, but it's very difficult in the most interesting cases to say, yes, this is clearly fair use, no, this is not clearly fair use. It's something that lawyers like to argue over. So FL 108, this is a Library of Congress circular that I encourage you all to Google when you get out of here. I'm going to go ahead and read the text of it. It is the Library of Congress talking about copyright in games. Copyright does not protect the idea for a game, its name or title, or the method or methods for playing it. Nor does copyright protect any idea, system, method, device, or trademark material involved in developing, merchandising, or playing a game. Once a game has been made public, nothing in the copyright law prevents others from developing another game based on similar principles. Copyright protects only the particular manner of an author's expression in literary, artistic, or musical form. So I think the Library of Congress knows a little something about copyright, and they're saying the fluff, the theme, the artwork, The particular expressive displays are covered by copyright, which is instant and automatic. But the methods, systems, and processes of playing that game, that's outside of copyright. That doesn't play in the land of copyright. That plays in the land of patents. Another piece of law, 17 U.S.C. Section 102B, just by coincidence, it's another 102B. And I'm going to go ahead and quote this one, another one that I think it's worthwhile to take a look at. In no case does copyright protection for an original work of authorship extend to any idea, procedure, process, system, method of operation, concept, principle, or discovery, regardless of the form in which it is described, explained, illustrated, or embodied in such work. So kind of the example I give on this one is this is essentially codifying Baker v. Selden from, I think, 1906. This is one of the key copyright cases you learn in law school when you take copyright law. In that case, we had somebody who came up with an accounting system, and they wrote a textbook explaining the accounting system. And somebody else started using the accounting system, and the creator of the accounting system sued them, saying, you're infringing my copyright in the accounting system. Supreme Court of the United States, I think this one was unanimous as well, said that there's no infringement of copyright here. Copyright applies to the textbook, applies to the way that you explain the accounting system. But the accounting system itself, either it's patented or it's not. So, again, my perspective on this, because we haven't had a huge number of litigation and actual court cases involving games because the industry is still kind of growing, is explain to me how the method, system, and process of playing a game is different from an accounting system. Because the Supreme Court of the United States said that plays in patent land when it comes to the system, the process, the method of accounting, or the method of playing the game. The copyright would extend to the way that you describe the rules and your rules of play, but not to the rules themselves. So, damages when it comes to a copyright. Everyone here is an unregistered copyright holder. I'm pretty certain of that. If somebody infringed your copyright and it wasn't, you know, subject to a limitation and exception, you would be entitled to actual damages. So the infringer's profits, the numbers that you can prove. So you've got to go to a judge and say, Your Honor, I lost $20,000, or he made $35,000. And you've got to be able to back that up. The burden of proof is upon you. And you're also entitled to an injunction stopping further infringement. Now, if you register the copyright in a timely fashion, and I'll talk about that in the next slide, but if you register it timely, you're entitled to actual damages, or you can say, you know what, Your Honor, it's kind of hard for me to prove numbers. Numbers are often difficult. I would rather you come up with a really big number for me, between $750 and $150,000 per work infringed, and I'll take that instead. Okay? That's usually a better number for the copyright holder. The copyright holder is also entitled to ask for attorney's fees. It's not a guarantee on their fees, but it's something you can ask for, and it's in the discretion of the judge. But that all depends upon timely registration. So in order to get these bonus damages, you have to register the work either pre-infringement or within 3 months of publication. So you've got to get that registration in early. The thing that I tell people is in order to sue someone over a copyright, you have to register it. So you can't get around that $30 fee or whatever the current amount is. You have to register it in order to file suit. So you might as well go ahead and do it a little bit early and have access to these bigger damages and realistically be able to write a much stronger demand letter saying cease and desist from infringing my copyright, because if you don't, I'll be able to obtain up to $150,000 per work infringed and you'll have to pay my attorney. So I really am a big fan of registration. Another statute I want to talk about is 17 U.S.C. Section 505. This is the section of the Copyright Act that says that a prevailing party is entitled to ask for their attorney's fees. Now, it's subject to the requirement that there is timely registration on the part of the plaintiff, on the part of the rights holder. But what this section also says, or what it's been interpreted to mean, is that if someone is sued for copyright infringement, but they end up prevailing, they end up saying, well, I wasn't actually infringing a copyright, I was sticking within the idea, sticking within the unpatented or unpatentable system, method, or process, or this was a fair use, then they're entitled to ask the judge for their attorney's fees. Because, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States and another circuit courts have said, copyright is not just about the rights holder. The rights holder is important. Again, we're trying to give them an incentive to come up with this work so it eventually flows into the public domain. But society has interests when it comes to copyrighted work, such as fair use, the idea, expression, dichotomy, etc. And when those interests are vindicated, the defendant is entitled to ask the judge for their fees. So how it plays out in the real world is copyright holders tend to take what I call a maximalist position, which is, this is property. You want to use my property, you got to get my permission. Okay? People that are reusing works tend to take the view of fair use is awesome, fair use is everywhere, you know, limitations and exceptions, privilege, whatever it is that I'm doing, regardless of the actual facts. And if we have digital files that are on a web server somewhere, the copyright holder might just say, well, you know, I'm not going to bother trying to track this person down. I'm just going to send a DMCA notice to the ISP and have the files go away, because there's a good chance I wouldn't be able to recover any money from this person anyway. And my key concern is making the infringement stop. So they oftentimes we end up seeing DMCA notices going out, which is actually a pretty good system in my opinion. Alternately, the copyright holder might send a cease and desist, an ASCII-gram that says you're infringing on this copyright. If you don't do X, Y, and Z, then there's a good chance that we'll sue you. Or they can just go ahead and file a lawsuit right off the bat. You're never required to tell somebody to stop infringing your rights. You're entitled, as soon as it happens, to walk down to the federal courthouse when it comes to copyright and file that lawsuit. But oftentimes we end up just seeing the cease and desist, and the behavior stops, and the rights holder decides, hey, you know what, it's not worth paying my lawyers to further pursue this, because even if I get a judgment for my fees, I've still got to find some actual money from the defendant to take to satisfy that judgment, and so getting the infringement to stop is a priority. How it should work, in my opinion, is that anybody that's engaging in commercial reuse should contact the rights holder and say, look, this is what I'm doing. I believe that it's subject to a limitation and exception, such as I'm focusing on the mechanics, I'm focusing on making an interoperable product with your method, system, or process, where this is fair use, but you know what? I like your company. I like the work that you do. I'd like to keep everybody on the same page. Let's work out a licensing deal. I'll send you some money without you having to do anything, and if you've got any suggestions on how I should market my product or whatever, I'm open to listening. I tend to take the perspective that it's better for parties to be proactive and talk with each other early in the process than to deal with, people getting angry and paying lawyers after the fact. Obviously, with certain companies, Hasbro's pretty big, Lego's pretty big. Are they actually going to listen to somebody who is, coming up with a third-party product or something that's on the ground? Maybe, maybe not. But with a lot of the game companies that are relatively small, they're, happy to see people reusing their product, and helping them gain mindshare, and they're open to actually talking with people and saying, yeah, let's work something out. As far as a, non-commercial reuser, contacting and saying, this is what I'm intending to do. If there's anything I can do to make you more comfortable, let's talk. If you want me to put a specific disclaimer or link back to your store or whatever, let's have a conversation about that. That's my perspective on it, but I also recognize that sometimes litigation is necessary in order to more clearly define the boundaries of rights and responsibilities. So that's what happens in copyright. Last major section is trademark. Trademarks are not a property right. I can cite to a dozen court cases off the top of my head that say trademarks are not a property right per se. They are intended to prevent a likelihood of consumer confusion. Trademarks are a consumer protection device. They are not property rights. Somebody can call a copyright or a patent property, and I won't look at them too weirdly, but if somebody calls a trademark property, I'm like, no, it's not. It is about preventing a likelihood of consumer confusion. Trademarks evolved out of unfair competition law. So, my trademark law textbook from back in law school is entitled Trademarks and Unfair Competition. Now, that suggests that there's certain competition that's fair. So this kind of brings us back to this default right to freely copy, subject to patents, trademarks, copyrights, etc. So trademarks are dealing, or trademark law is dealing with, when is this competition unfair? Basics of trademarks. Trademark is going to cover any mark, symbol, or device that is used to indicate source. And our key test for infringement is a likelihood of consumer confusion. It's not, did you copy the mark? It's not, were you acting out of ill intent? It's, are your actions likely to cause consumer confusion? Now, when we try and differentiate marks, the three primary factors we look to is we look to the marks themselves. if you're literally copying a mark or using the exact same name, you know what? That's probably going to cause consumer confusion. But, you know, to use Fantasy Flight as an example, if you started up, you know, Fantasy, you know, Walk Games, you know what? It's not the exact same mark, but it's pretty close, and people are likely going to be, you know, confused when it comes to that. You're also going to look at the industry of the goods or service that's involved. So somebody takes a mark that's being used in board games and starts using them for role-playing games. Well, that's not strictly the same industry, but it's pretty darn close. You look at a convention, you look at where these goods or services are being offered in a supermarket or whatever. If they're pretty close to each other or you're going to be seeing them more or less the same time, that's pretty strong evidence that the industries overlap. Whereas if you've got one person who's making board games and one person who's using a mark that's relatively similar, but they're putting it on cars, well, you know what, those industries really don't overlap too much. The third criteria that we look at in trying to determine, okay, is there a likelihood of consumer confusion, is the geographic locations involved. Anyone here heard of this thing called the internet? You know, the geography question has become a lot less interesting, or at least a lot less vital, because, you know, in the old days, you would have people that are creating goods and services in California and people that are creating goods and services in Maine, and they could use the exact same literal mark for the exact same literal industry, but if you never have a consumer that's seen both of those marks, there's no likelihood of consumer confusion. So it's geographically restricted. But with the internet, when you're able to make your goods and services available to more or less anybody, right off the bat, the geography question becomes a little less of a key. So how do you avoid problems when it comes to trademarks? One thing you can do is you can hire a lawyer early in the process. And if it's an endeavor that you're intending to put a significant amount of capital behind, I really think that's a good idea. But what the bare minimum that you can do is do a wide-ranging Google search, do a wide-ranging test search. That's the trademark. Actually, I don't even remember what test stands for off the top of my head. But it's the search engine that the USPTO uses for searching the registrations. And don't just search for the name that you're using. Search for the names of synonyms. So if your mark incorporates the word insane, search on the word crazy. Search on a variety of other words that have the same meaning or kind of sort of the same meaning as whatever the word is. And see if there's anybody who is out there. Another recommendation that I make is federally register your mark early in the process. It's not free. It's going to cost you at the very least $275 per class of good or services. Oftentimes, people will fall into two or three classes for, you know, goods and services. But and you know, you'll need to pay your lawyer if you're using a lawyer for it. But it's worth it to get it registered, because what that's going to do is it's going to give you nationwide constructive use. So the geography question completely goes away. You are treated as if you're operating in the full United States, even if you're only selling it out of your basement in Idaho. Okay? The other reason that it's really important is that it puts other individuals on constructive notice. It's presumed that somebody else who is using a mark has searched the Federal Trademark Register. And from a very practical standpoint, it makes a lot of problems go away without you even finding out about it, because other people come in, they're thinking about using a mark that's the same or similar, they do the trademark search on the USPTO website and say, oh, well, there's this guy out of Idaho who's using this mark, I guess I'll come up with something else. So it's all the problems that you never find out about is one of the key values of registering the mark. The other value out of it is that if you do run into a trademark problem, the demand letter, you know, where you send it to the other side saying, you know, I have these rights and you're infringing them, stop, is you get to attach the federal registration and say, I hold federal registration number, whatever the number is, and it makes, you know, the document look that much more impressive, because guess what? You've got proof that you have certain rights in this mark. So, nominative fair use. Talked previously about limitations and exceptions to copyright. This is a limitation and exception, if you will, when it comes to trademarks. Now, what this really deals with is it deals with the question of likelihood of consumer confusion. Nominative fair use is when you're wanting to use someone else's mark, not as a signifier of source, but rather as a way to reference the other person's goods or service. So the example that's used in the leading case on this is the Chicago Bulls. Chicago Bulls is a trademark. It signifies source for professional basketball entertainment services and a variety of other stuff, such as jerseys and stuff like that. But if you wanted to reference those entertainment services that are provided or, you know, marketed under the Mark Chicago Bulls, it's extremely clumsy to say, you know, this is a report or this is a recap of the game involving a professional basketball team from Chicago. Because guess what? There's actually a couple professional basketball teams from Chicago. And so you can use that mark. You can copy that mark, if you will, in order to talk about or reference the underlying goods or services, but you're not using it to signify source or sponsorship or affiliation. The three key criteria for nominative fair use is that the product or service can't be readily identified without the mark. It's very clumsy to describe the actual generic goods or services that are being provided, and people recognize the mark and recognize it as a shorthand. You're only using so much of the mark as is necessary. The case I really like to cite, too, is down in Florida with the Disney World mark, where somebody completely unaffiliated with Disney put together a map of the area saying, this is where we're located, and here's Disney World. So if you get to Disney World, you go two blocks this way, then turn left, and this is where we're at. But what they did is they didn't just write Disney World. They used the Disney script, and I think they also used the little Cinderella's castle, or they used the full mark itself. And what the district court said was, well, you used too much. You didn't need to use the script that's associated with Disney. You didn't need to use, you know, their actual graphical elements of the mark. And so you use too much, and this isn't nominative fair use. This is causing consumer confusion as far as, do you have some affiliation with them? So you only use so much as you need to. And finally, you don't do anything that would suggest sponsorship or endorsement. So sponsorship or endorsement is a key aspect of trademark infringement. People often get sued not because they are suggesting that they are the source, but they are suggesting that they have some sponsorship deal or they've been endorsed by that source or they've got some relationship when there is none there. And so this can become thorny when it comes to gaming if people are trying to make third-party products that are interoperable with a pre-existing work, or if they're trying to create, you know, additional missions or scenarios or whatever. And so my statement is, disclaimers are your friend. Explicitly putting on the product, you know, this product is not affiliated with Days of Wonder, the maker of the Memoir 44 system, or whatever. Being very explicit, so if for whatever reason someone would possibly be confused, you're helping to dispel that as soon as possible. So, trade secret. This is more or less a single slider. So, trade secrets, these apply to knowledge with commercial value that is not generally known and that reasonable steps are taken to keep confidential. So, you are using NDAs, you're not, you know, setting it up, you know, in the middle of the street to show everybody. Very easy way to avoid trouble with trade secrets is, don't reuse confidential information. If you have any questions on this, again, you can consult a lawyer to find out if trade secret protection applies. As far as keeping your own trade secrets, NDAs are your friend, avoiding posting about stuff on BoardGameGeek or other publicly accessible sites. Again, kind of use common sense when it comes to, hey, I'm trying to keep this secret to derive commercial advantage about it. Well, keep it secret. Right of publicity is kind of a cousin of trademark. It deals with the commercial reuse of someone's name, image, or likeness. There are some fair use-esque exceptions to right of publicity. We've got court cases dealing with individuals that took likenesses of famous actors and put them on T-shirts, but they rendered their image or they came up with some way to comment about who that individual was and what their role in the culture was. But when it comes to the right of publicity, these exceptions are generally narrower than the copyright aspect. So if their, you know, face, for example, were an art painting of just some random person that somebody had invented, reuse of it might have been fair use in the copyright context, but it wouldn't be considered fair use, if you will, within the right of publicity context.
Does that require to be a lot?
No. The right of publicity, well, actually, it depends on which state you're in. It depends on which state is implicated, because the copyright and patent is federal, so we've got more or less uniform law on that. Trademark is predominantly federal. Right of publicity is completely state-based, which means that some states say, like for example here in Indiana, if I remember correctly, it's life of the individual plus another 100 years after that. Other states, there's a statute that says it ends when you die, and so it's really going to depend.
But it's specific to people?
Yes, your cat does not have a right of publicity.
Well, no, but a corporate entity doesn't either.
No. There might be trademark issues, there might be defamation issues, there might be tortious interference with business relations, but
right.
not right of publicity. And right of publicity evolved out of a right of privacy.
Right.
Your right as an individual to not be thrust into the public eye if you don't want to. So, permission can be implied when it comes to right of publicity. If you look on the back of your badge, it'll say something about, let's see, which includes, okay, to use and authorize the use of his or her name, voice, likeness, and all reproductions hereof by any means and in all media now and hereafter now. So that sentence or that portion of that sentence is you basically agreeing that, you know, Fantasy Flight or whoever can videotape you or photograph you and they can say, hey, look at our awesome booth, and hey, Neil happens to be in the background. There's no right of publicity issue because I've waived that via contract or something kind of sort of resembling a contract. So, these are the credits for the images that I've used. Second page of credits. And if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to take them, talk afterwards. What do you got?
Superman.
Yes.
Can you mention Superman?
You can mention him. And again, the point here is that, one of the key points that I want you to make, is that get away from thinking, this is someone's intellectual property. If I want to use it, I have to get permission. It's, what do we have there? There is a trademark that signifies source. There is a copyright in the storylines, in the artwork. There are limitations and exceptions to reproductions of that, of those images, of those storylines, etc. So it depends on how it is you're wanting to use Superman in order to figure out, are we using copyrighted aspects? Are we using trademarked aspects? Are we using, well, there's no right of publicity because he wasn't an actual human being. And then figuring out, okay, does this violate one of the exclusive rights? And if it does, is there a limitation and exception that privileges it? So it sounds like you might have a specific.
So you can just point to ask, look, this is a reference that people know about.
Mm-hmm.
You say Superman, everyone knows what Superman means.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just point to that. This is just a trademark, pointing at that trademark, and you can freely do that.
Well, it depends on are you creating a likelihood of consumer confusion. So it's going to be the whole circumstance. So if you're writing a scholarly essay on the influence of Superman on board gaming or whatever, consumers who see that aren't going to think, well, gee, I think it's DC that holds the copyrights of Superman. Hey, this guy is, you know, affiliated or endorsed or has some sponsorship deal with Superman. Whereas if, you know, it really does depend on the facts. And the other point that I really want to make is that, you know, even if the law is on your side, or you feel relatively confident that the law is on your side, that doesn't mean that you're not going to get sued. That doesn't mean that people aren't going to say bad things about you and say, you're a dirty pirate, or you're a dirty thief, or you're ripping me off, or whatever. Okay? And again, you know, one of the very first slides, it's not just about the law. It's about norms. It's about what do we as a community want to, you know, do and use. So kind of the example I use is that a lot of game design, our processes, systems, methods, and, you know, after 1 year of public use, they're going to flow into the public domain, but that doesn't prevent individuals from, you know, signing contracts with publishers and saying, hey, I'm going to do this, and that goes back to the nature of what a contract is and what the considerations are going back and forth. But the point I want to make is that it's practically unheard of for a publisher or anyone else to say, well, you know what, thanks for disclosing your great idea to me, but I can see that you previously talked about it on Board Game Geek, and therefore it's unpatentable, and I'm just going to go and use this on my own and not give you anything. Ha, 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 ha. Social norms would shut that down, and does shut that down. So, you know, these are very important. You know, even if I take a look at all the, you know, the facts and say, well, my legal opinion is that, well, this was the public use, and under 35 U.S.C. 102B, it flowed into the public domain. That doesn't stop people from acting based on norms. And I think that's a good thing. I think that we should be setting up situations where everybody involved gets paid for their efforts and, you know, gets reasonable compensation and everything else, but we have a lot of policies that are going back and forth, a lot of often mutually conflicting goals, and that, hey, we want to see inventors and people who do hard work get paid for it and make money for it, but copyright isn't based on, and patents aren't based on how hard you worked. It's based on, is it useful, novel, and non-obvious to one having ordinary skill in the art? It's an original work of authorship fixed in a tangible medium of expression. And we also want to ensure that what's in the public domain is, in fact, in the public domain, and people can use it because copying and building upon the past is how we advance as a society and how we come up with new and awesome stuff. So really difficult, really thorny questions, which is a long way of saying it depends.
If you're considering a derivative work on a public domain copyright, after it's expired in a long time.
If it's public domain, that means there is no copyright.
Right. What sort of infringement would someone else have to do? How close would they have to get to your derivative work for it to be considered an infringement on your copyright of that original work?
Well,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, I think I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
I'll answer with an example. I can take the text of Romeo and Juliet, long since in the public domain because it was written for the Statute of Anne before we even had copyright. You know, some great works got written without the incentive of copyright. I could take that text, and I could come up with a new edition, add some illustrations to it, put some really great cover artwork on it, and I can register that copyright. You can and should register copyrights in games, okay? And there's even a process by which you send in the game to the Library of Congress, and actually I think it's an FL 108 that actually walks through that. Because what's going to happen is that the registration will issue, and under 17 USC 102B, it's going to extend to the copyrightable elements within that work. Okay? It's not going to extend to the method systems and processes. It's not going to extend to normally copyrightable elements that have already expired or were never under copyright to begin with. And so I'll have this copyright on my new edition of Romeo and Juliet. So when you take from the public domain and create a derivative work, you make some changes to it, you build something on top of it, you have a copyright, you can file the copyright registration, but it's only going to extend to your original works of authorship. Okay? And so the scope of your copyright is going to be relatively thin if you haven't done much to change it. Might be a lot more robust if you changed a lot, such as West Side Story, taking Romeo and Juliet and changing the context and coming up with these gangs and everything else. So someone else is free, they remain free to reach in and take the public domain elements, take the stuff that wasn't an original work of authorship, take the stuff that is a system, method, or process and wasn't filed for patent. They can take that and reuse it just as you had the right to take that and reuse it. So, did that answer your question?
Pretty much. Using the case of the West Side Story, actually, if someone were to take Romeo and Juliet and then make a story that's written rather than a play, and it was close to West Side Story, then that would be considered an infringement. But if it were something completely different, you know, science fiction, you know, mm-hmm. outer space or something like that, then they would be a derivative of the original and have no connection or infringement on West Side Story, correct?
Right. They can go back to the original public domain source, and they can come up with an original work of authorship that's based upon that. And in fact, somebody could go back to the original Romeo and Juliet and somehow magically come up with West Side Story. And that wouldn't be an infringement of copyright so long as they had no access to the original West Side Story. Copyright infringement requires access to the original work. Patent infringement doesn't. Patent infringement doesn't matter if you had access to it, doesn't matter if you know about it. In fact, one of the cases often called the Bee Gees case. I can't remember the actual name of it. Mm. But it dealt with where the musical group, the Bee Gees, they put out a record, and this guy goes to court and says, well, that's substantially similar to my prior work, and you know, I want damages for copyright infringement. And the Bee Gees actually said, well, here's all our tapes from our recording sessions, and during this entire time period that you had published the work before we published our single, we were in the mountains in some European country. We were completely secluded, and we have all this evidence to show that we were completely secluded, we never had access to your work, and so we couldn't have copied it. You're right, we agree with you that these works are substantially similar, but we never had access, and so no infringement. Now, you know, again, the key point is that you might have a hard time convincing a judge of that. You might have a hard time convincing your friends and neighbors of that. But if those actually are, in fact, the facts, and you can prove that, there's no infringement. It's going to determine on what state, because again, the right of publicity is state specific. And so if the individual's dead, you're going to have to look at, well, what state did they reside in? What's the law for determining what state's law applies? So the answer is literally, it depends. I need to know more facts and do some research.
Yeah. Who's the, in the case where someone's dead, who's the infringed party?
The right of publicity is, in many states, is considered to be divisible, which means that if you can pass it by will, or if you die without a will, it's called dying intestate, and the state has this, you know, list of, well, if you had a surviving spouse and no kids, surviving spouse takes everything, surviving spouse with kids, spouse gets half, kids get half. I mean, there's kind of a will by default, and so it would pass according to that. Anyone else have any questions, comments, concerns, thoughts?
I have one really silly question. I think. So if I'm trying to go with a mark to use for something, right, and there's a database of these marks that are registered, how does one search it?
You type in the text.
Well, what if it's just a symbol?
Oh, just a symbol? Then you can actually try and describe the symbol, because not only is the symbol going to be registered, but there's also going to be a text description of it. But you're running into a lot of the same issues with patents, where we think of patents as being on invention, being on something tangible, but it's really not. The scope of the patent is determined by the claims. And so we're trying to translate this inventive concept into English. And so in the trademark concept, we translate this graphical mark into text as well as having the mark registered. But, and again, you could run into a situation where, depending on, you know, how the mark is, how substantially similar they are, how, you know, what the relevant industries are, you could end up, you know, infringing on the mark. But it's a little less likely that you're going to come up with something that's really similar to that without actually having seen it.
Right. So.
Actually, I think you had your hand up a second ago, and I missed your
part. Well, you talked about how that applies to like works and stuff like that. How does that apply to locations? Say, for instance, I was putting out a game, regardless of type, and I wanted to use landscapes of Indianapolis and, in fact, reference Indianapolis like on the card or somewhere in the game. And, you know, it's like Indianapolis. It's a playable thing. How does that, how would I legally do that? Would I have to contact Indianapolis or, you know, the location I'm using and say, I actually want to reference you in this game. Is that okay?
Okay. The city of Indianapolis does not have a trademark right in the word Indianapolis. Okay. Now, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department would have a trademark in that, but only to the extent in which you are causing consumer confusion as to, is this guy endorsed by the IMPD? Is this guy affiliated with them? If there's a tourist campaign, you know, I don't think we're doing anything right now, or if we are, we're obviously not doing a very good job because I live here, I'm not even aware of it. I know the state of Michigan has a big advertising campaign called Pure Michigan. And so if you're referencing that mark or doing something that's, you know, similar to that, so you write a, you know, a book called Pure Michigan or something like that, then you're starting to walk into some possible trademark issues. But as you know, but when you're dealing with, you know, the word Indianapolis, that in and of itself, there's no trademark right there. The key point is, would a consumer think, hey, this guy has some official sponsorship or affiliation with the city of Indianapolis or whatever the department is?
So, like, using an artistic rendering of the skyline is okay?
I mean, there's no copyright right or trademark right in that skyline. Now, people may, like, I know the Space Needle, what they do is they restrict access to people who take photographs from the Space Needle in Seattle. But that's based on their ownership of the property and saying, we're not letting you on our property because we have a right to exclude people from our real property and physical property, and Space Needle's privately held. We're going to exclude you from this if you don't agree to our terms for taking works from inside, but that's not based on copyright or trademark. That's based on their actual land use. So, you know, again, if you're taking the photo yourself, or you've entered into some sort of agreement with the copyright holder, I'm having a hard time seeing how an issue could come about.
But it'd still be better to, you know, like, again, if you're taking a picture of Indianapolis and putting the word Indianapolis on it, just contact the government and say, hey, I'm using this.
I mean, you can. I mean, the thing with that is that I'm having just such a hard time finding any sort of likelihood of consumer confusion for that. You know, if you're doing something where, you know, you're going to, say, a private entity like Kings Island or Cedar Point, you're taking photographs or wanting to reuse stuff like that, you get a little bit close to, are people going to be confused as to, whether you've got a relationship with them. But I just have kind of a hard time seeing how you can cause that confusion when it comes to governmental entities.
Here's an example. The vampire gangs put out source books with city names on them. I really doubt they contacted each city and said, may I use your name?
It's a legitimate question. I'm just trying to
defamation. Would that be against where would that fall? Because if you say, for instance, Detroit,
my wife's from Detroit, so go ahead.
But she's not there now. No. Okay,
you know, you say Detroit, and you do a game of Detroit 2011, and use Mad Max elements. You're likely to get a 50% chance to save rate of getting shot from walking out your front door. There could be some kind of litigation on your...
Well, anyone can sue you for any reason. The question is, are they going to be successful?
Are there grounds for some kind of defamation from city officials to say, okay, you're casting us in a bad light, a very bad light? Detroit is going to suffer.
you want to know why?
It's property values. It's extreme. It's absurd. But is there some kind of that? I mean, would that be? That's not copyright. That's not trademark.
No.
It's supposed to run 4, right?
I think officially
4:30.
4:30.
Oh, 4:30.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome to leave. You got some.
Oh, no. I was going to be walked out of the room.
No, I'm not going to be. I don't think there's something here until 5. Okay, but as far as are you saying bad things about a city? Well, your opinion is protected by the First Amendment. And, we have case law that interprets defamation torts and invasion of privacy torts to ensure that we have breathing space for the First Amendment. So if your opinion is Detroit is an unsafe city and you're wanting to comment on that and create a work based upon that, I'm having trouble seeing how the city of Detroit is going to be successful in suing you for that. So you got a question on it here?
Oh, I just remember hearing in the last year, I think there was actually a case of that where a city tried to sue a magazine because, and I think it was in Indiana, where they tried to sue a magazine because they were like top 10 cities that are or towns that are shrinking in Indiana. And I'm trying to remember, I don't remember the whole thing, but anything about that.
Yeah, of course, I'm not familiar with that particular case. I'm having trouble seeing what the cause of action is. if it's a truthful statement. You had a question on
that? I was going to comment on that. Since you're the lawyer, if we looked at the angle of satire, wouldn't that carry over on that type of situation, since they're saying this isn't the true state of the city, this is a what-if?
Right. Well, I mean, with satire and parody are very interesting under copyright law, because parody tends to give you a pretty wide berth when it comes to fair use, but satire doesn't give you as much. And which I find very interesting, because we're essentially saying your First Amendment protections depend on who your target is. If you're using somebody's work to poke fun at them, well, that's parody. We'll give you a wider berth. You're using someone's work to poke fun at someone else, at a third party, well, that's satire. We're going to get less protection of that. And I'm specifically thinking of the Cat in the Hat cases, where somebody took Dr. Seuss and used it to poke fun at O.J. Simpson. Talking about, one wife, two wife, dead wife, the Ninth Circuit said this is satire, which means it's not parody, which means we're not going to give it as wide of a berth, we're not going to call this fair use. Congratulations, the state of Theodore Geisel, here's your injunction, here's your damages. I think that case was decided wrongly, but that's the case law, is that satire gets less protection than parody, so it depends on who your target is. But
was that followed through the Supreme Court? Or did it just
I believe cert was requested, which is the fancy way of the party said, hey, Supreme Court, please look at this case, and the Supreme Court said, no thanks. Because they're not required. They deny 99% of the appeals that go up to them. But,
I'm a school librarian, so a couple years ago.
That means you're awesome, by the way.
Thank you. But I started getting a lot of questions in my school about copyright and all this kind of stuff, fair use and educational use and stuff. Right. I basically had to take a few seminars on copyright in schools, and they said a safe way to think about it I mean, this is not for if you're publishing a game, you're afraid of getting sued by a giant company. But like they said, basically the best way to think about it, I just want to get your opinion on this, is if you harm the market value of a product, or if you cause, like you said, confusion, then you're generally probably violating some type of copyright or infringing on. You know, but if you were to put something out, like you said, with Indianapolis on it, you're not actually harming the value of the city.
Well,
what you said with Detroit was interesting because you could be, theoretically, but you remember that company when Borat came out? And they had that thing where he was saying he was from that country, and the actual country said, wait a minute, like, you're harming the value.
Please stop.
Yeah. So they didn't actually sue him, but they launched, like, a campaign to
using social norms to
right. So I think, is that a safe way to think about things?
I think it's an incomplete way. Okay. And part of it, and I've actually done a lot of work with Kenny Cruz at the Columbia University Copyright Advisory Office, which, and he's done he taught my copyright law class in law school, a brilliant guy. And he's done a lot of work with librarians, museums. In fact, there's a case going on in Georgia where Georgia State's library system, the state university was sued for their electronic reserves. And so I was helping him with some of the research, getting his expert witness testimony together. So, I mean, I actually have some background in the librarians and everything else. And part of the problem is that fair use is so amorphous. And so we try and come up with shortcuts or guidelines or rules of thumb. And, you know, the rule of thumb is if this harms the market for the original work, then it's less likely to be a fair use. That's true.
Right.
But it's incorrect to say if this harms the market for the original work, then it's not fair use. You know, the fourth factor of fair use looks at the economic impact of the original work. And so that's an important factor. But the first factor is this transformative? Is this educational? Is this non-commercial? That's important, too.
Right.
As to likelihood of consumer confusion, again, that's on the trademark side. And so if it's confusing people as to source, well, that's not necessarily going to be relevant to the fair use analysis. I know there's been a lot of guidelines in this is a continuum. I mean, there are conferences and all sorts of things on trying to make fair use manageable and say, here's your three-step process that you go through to come to your clear conclusion of, yes, this is allowed, no, it's not. And that's not how the law is set up. It's set up on, here are the factors we consider, here are the specific cases that have come before that give us something resembling signposts, but at the end of the day, the judge has to make the call, and a lot of people aren't willing to spend the money and expense to litigate to that point. So... yes.
Not to open a huge can, but I was.
But you're going to anyway. That's okay.
I'm going to ask. And I hope it doesn't. what's your opinion on how OGL, Open Game License, and Creative Commons type things affect those?
Well, I'll tell you my biases. If it hasn't been apparent, big fan of Creative Commons. Big fan of Open Gaming License. I think that our copyright system is a great idea, but it's currently a bit unbalanced. Like, for example, you look at term. 95 years for work made for hire. If you need 95 years to turn a profit on something, you're probably in the wrong industry.
So,
can I quote you?
I publicly stated that. I mean, it's Cory Doctorow. That's who I'm quoting. But my personal thoughts on, yes, I'm big fans of those systems. I'm big fans on coming up with ways, because not every reuse of a copyrighted work harms the original copyright holder. And oftentimes, I think smart copyright holders are going to look to, how can we have other people do work for us, do stuff for us that's going to make us more money? And part of that is, well, let's get the lawyers out of this or make them less of an issue and use a standard license or come up with terms that says, hey, we're cool with you doing this. We're cool with this, and so long as you stay within the terms of this, we're not going to sue you. I think that's great. I think that many times it's going to lead to increased revenue. So, I give a thumbs up to that. But
is it technically just a waiver of the rights?
No, it's not a waiver of the rights. It is a license. It is permission.
So, okay, so the Creative Commons is just a common license, but the copyrights still remain.
Right. The copyright remains. And you can take down
the license.
You can stop the license, which means that people that previously had the license, because the way the text of the Creative Commons license is written, it says that you can take this license away, you can change your mind. But people who have previously accepted the license and have relied upon it, they get to maintain their rights, but you can stop new people from gaining those rights. Whereas if it was a waiver of the rights, then those rights would be gone forever and ever and ever on that. So, did you have a question?
My question had to do with the consumer confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I know it probably wouldn't help in every case, but wouldn't proper use of a disclaimer help with an item like consumer confusion? Like if you have something at the bottom saying, you know, we're really not associated or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what it's going
right.
on.
But it still needs to be nominative fair use. So you've got those three factors in that. You're using it to refer to the underlying goods and services as opposed to using it as a signifier of source. And you know, you can't use more than you need to. And you're avoiding sponsorship, you know, suggestion of sponsorship or endorsement. So I can't just take the Fantasy Flight mark, come up with my own game, put Fantasy Flight Games on it, and then say, you know, on the front of it, not actually affiliated or endorsed by Fantasy Flight. You know, you can't do that. But, you know, if I'm coming up with, you know, an expansion or a module or a variant or whatever, and I'm saying this is compatible with the Fantasy Flight product, whatever, or just calling it by the game name, which you can argue very strongly is a trademark, but saying, hey, not affiliated, but then this is a third party, looking at the law itself, that gives you a much better shot of saying, well, yeah, this is nominative fair use. Does that mean Fantasy Flight's not going to sue you? No. They can still sue you. They can still send you a cease and desist. They can still say nasty things about you. And again, maybe it's violative of norms. We can have that discussion on what people should or shouldn't be doing or what's fair or whatever. But, you know, when we're looking at, well, there is fair use, there is the idea expression dichotomy, there is these limitations and exceptions, which means that those are rights that the public has, that other people have, just as Fantasy Flight, again, not trying to pick on them, they're just, you know, a lot of the games on my shelf have that logo on it, so I think of them immediately. Just as they had access to those rights and they were able to build upon the past when they were creating their products, the next generation has those same rights. So, you know, it's not something where you just say, hey, I've got a disclaimer, I have an infringed trademark. It's, hey, this is part of the total package of using the mark to refer to the underlying goods and services as opposed to using the mark to signify source. Yeah?
Somewhat related. I've got a game I've been working on for a couple years, and it's a game system that allows you to use game managers from
okay.
other companies. If I picture another company's miniatures in my rule book,
mm-hmm.
is that an infringement? I bought a blister pack, I've assembled their model, I've painted it, I've you know, materially changed it quite
okay.
a bit, but it is a Games Workshop
mm-hmm.
miniature or
mm-hmm.
something I bought from Cool Mini, whatever.
Okay. The official legal answer is, it depends. And I know that's not very satisfying, but I'll give you kind of the thought process. Is that what you're doing there is you're engaging in a reproduction. First sale sounds like you have lawfully acquired these minis. First sale says that distributions and public displays are not infringements of copyright under first sale. But here you're reproducing and you're creating derivative works. So that doesn't fall under first sale. It may fall under fair use. And so you've got to go through the fair use analysis to say, okay, is this a transformative use? Is it a non-commercial use? Is it an educational use? Well, that's going to make it more likely to be fair. Is this going to impact the market for, you know, the legitimate market that the original rights holder is going to have? Will that make it less likely to be a fair use? Have to go through that whole analysis to say, okay, is this fair or is this not? Because you are, in fact, using some of the 106, 17 U.S.C. 106 rights. On the trademark side, it all revolves around, is there a likelihood of consumer confusion as to affiliation, endorsement, or source? And so if somebody who is seeing that, the ordinary gamer or whoever the market is, the people that are going to be buying this product, are they going to be confused and think that you have some affiliation or endorsement, and I'll give you one second, with whomever the original source is? There's also the practical question of, are you going to get sued for it? Because even if you retain me and you pay me a bunch of money and I do the research and I give you a really fancy, lengthy letter on my letterhead that says, it is my professional opinion that you are not infringing on copyright or causing a likelihood of consumer confusion, that doesn't prevent anybody else from suing you.
Sure.
That doesn't prevent anybody else from saying nasty things about you. So there's a lot more to it than just the law, and I've focused primarily on the law. But the actual legal answer at this point, it depends. which is great because it gives us flexible standards to use so we're not locked into 1978 technology, which is when the last major update to the Copyright Act was. But it's maddening in that it's hard to come up with clear answers, and it's really just along a continuum of probability. Question?
No. Would it just be easier in that specific instance to contact the copyright or trademark holder and gain a license from that?
Yeah, and I think that there are many situations in which that would make sense.
And it would actually benefit the copyright as well.
Right, and now, again, it depends partially on who the rights holder is. Games Workshop has a bit of a reputation of being very, I'll just say, litigious, and being very proactive, I'll be a little more neutral, in enforcing what they, you know, believe to be their rights. And that's their right under the legal system. They're allowed to say, this is our perspective, this is our opinion, and they're allowed to file lawsuits. So you kind of have to figure out, okay, who is it that I'm dealing with? If it's someone that you think might be open to discussions, I often think it's worthwhile to go ahead and make contact and say, here's my argument, here's my thought process on this, and heck, I've talked to a lawyer or have a lawyer make contact and say, but we recognize that reasonable people can disagree. We think that there's no need here, but I probably wouldn't say reasonable people can disagree. But say, you know, something along the lines of, like and respect your work, want to keep everybody happy, it really doesn't benefit anybody but the lawyers for us to fight this out, can we come up with something? I'm happy to send you a single-digit percentage of the money that I make off of this. I'll just send you a check every month or every quarter or whatever. If there's anything that I can do to make you more comfortable with this, let me know. Maybe you really don't like books being published with red covers. If you'd like a brown cover, okay, that's cool. You know, whatever the case may be. But it does depend a bit on who the entity is. And the thing that I love about the gaming industry is that a lot of the entities are relatively small, and so you can have that kind of that personal connection or relationship. And a lot of people, you know, or companies say, awesome, you're using our stuff. You're exposing our product to more people. Thank you. So, other questions, thoughts, comments, concerns? Happy to hang out a little bit afterwards, or
another.
And you guys are also free to leave at any time. I mean, I'm not going to be insulted.
Copyright question.
Yeah, I've got this.
I think I know the answer from listening to your.
The answer is it depends. But
yeah. So I'm working on a game for 5 years, mm-hmm. a real job, you know. So you go back and forth and you have your spare time. The minute first document was created, copyright 2006, whatever. And every time I work on it, whatever year it is, put a little copyright.
Well, actually, the copyright, the year is not a reflection of what calendar year it currently is. The year is a reflection of when the work was actually created. Now, can somebody sue you for putting the wrong year in a copyrighted work? The answer probably is no. Technically, there's something called copyright misuse, but it's pretty toothless. But I'll go off on a bit of a tangent, and then I'll let you continue your story of thoughts. But to explain what that copyright notice means, prior to January 1st, 1978, copyright was an opt-in regime, which means if you didn't opt in, if you didn't fill out the form, write the check, send a copy to the Library of Congress, put on the front page of all the works, copyright 1966, Neil A. Winneman, all rights reserved, then you waived your copyright. There was no copyright in the work. If you weren't willing to do a small amount of effort to say, this is commercially valuable to me, I'm going to tell people when the copyright expires, and I'm going, because they can do math on the year, and going to tell people who holds the copyright so they can contact that individual to seek a license, then they went into the public domain for anybody to use. That was the intentional design of the system. If it wasn't worth a little bit of effort to you, we're going to make it available to everyone because somebody else might be able to put some effort and make it worthwhile to them or benefit society. January 1st, 1978, that changed. Copyright became instant automatic. Now, we kept the registration system in order to give additional rights and kind of have this throwback to the utilitarian system of we're trying to give enough rights to incentivize that first creation but not necessarily starve the public domain. So the whole point of that year is not to tell people, hey, guess what, it's 2011 now. It's to say this work was created in that year so you can calculate when the copyright expires. But go ahead and continue on your discussion.
So I guess the question would be, if I release the game next year, does it, do I put copyright 2000?
2006 when I started it, or 2012 when I registered the copyright.
Okay. The technical dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's is going to be when was an original work of authorship fixed in a tangible medium of expression? When the copyrightable elements were tangibly fixed, that's the year. Now, the reality in the United States is that copyright lasts for life of the author plus 70 years, or if it's a work made for hire, 95 years, just a flat 95. And Congress has this habit of retroactively extending copyright whenever Mickey Mouse is about to fall into the public domain because Disney has a bunch of money and congressmen are cheap. So, realistically, we're instituting a system of perpetual copyright. And so I tangibly fixed it in December of 2010, but I didn't make it available to the public till January 2011. You can put copyright 2011 on it, and no one's going to kick in your door and take your game away from you or sue you or what. It's just probably not going to happen. But if you wanted to be technically correct, Bill, the copyright's going to be running from 2010. So, other questions? All right. If you want to get me afterwards, happy to talk. I've got business cards if people want them, and take them there.